Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Mark Yale Harris, highly acclaimed sculptor and business entrepreneur, speaking with us from his studio in Carbondale, Colorado. Mark left the business world at the age of 62 to follow his lifelong passion of becoming a full-time artist. Mark has become as innovative, entrepreneurial, and as successful in his art career as he was in business. With the invaluable experience of the mentorship of renowned sculptors Bill Prokopioff and Doug Hyde, along with intense workshops and ongoing studies, he developed his artistic skills and unique vision and has created an immense, evolving body of work in alabaster, marble, limestone, and bronze. Mark has exhibited his works in numerous solo, museum, and group exhibitions, nationally and internationally, such as at the Royal Academy of London and the Austin Museum of Art. Mark is represented by multiple prominent galleries in the US and UK. His work is held in many prestigious private, corporate, and public collections, such as the Hilton Hotels, Booth Western Art Museum, the Open Air Museum in Ubi, Japan, and his sculptures and career have been featured in several renowned magazines, books, and publications. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us. In an intriguing quote from your website video, you reflect on how identifying with one's own creative process can be elusive. How did the journey unfold for you as you moved closer to identifying with your creative process?
As you mentioned in your introduction, I sold my company, I believe it was 1996, and was doing various real estate transactions, buying and selling properties in Austin, Texas, which was my home at the time. And I was also taking classes in art, evenings and weekends, or take a week or two and go to Santa Fe and study. I had the opportunity to go to Santa Fe and study with Bill Prokopioff, who was an Aleut from the Aleutian Islands, a Native American, who had been identified early as a young man and brought to Santa Fe to study in what was known as the IAIA, American Indian Arts Association. And I had purchased his work over time. And as a result, I contacted him and said, Bill, guess what I'm doing? I'm doing what you do. And would you ever consider to give me some lessons? And he said, sure. I said, well, what would that cost you? And he said, well, how about a bottle of vodka and a steak dinner? And I said, that sounds like a good deal to me. So I went out to Santa Fe and spent time with him on several occasions. I finally decided in 2000, I guess would be the best date to say, that I'd make a commitment and let go of all my business activities, at least for a while, and just immerse myself in art. So I went out to Santa Fe in 1999-2000, and I fell in love is the best words I can use to describe the experience. I was surrounded by a number of other artists and sculptors and other forms of visual art. For me, it was like having the opportunity to play golf with Jack Nicklaus. It was just a thrilling experience. Based on an emotional response, I made the decision to move out there for a permanent basis and pursue art as a second career. I had the opportunity when I moved out there to move into a studio with another Native American who is a Nez Perce Indian by the name of Doug Hyde. Doug and Bill were close friends, and he welcomed me into his studio. It was a result of the time I spent in his studio and around him that I picked up a lot of knowledge about not so much how to create, but how to use the various tools and techniques to render sculpture. I spent 6 months with Doug, and in the process and our friendship, I said, am I any good at this? He said, yeah, you're good. I said, can I succeed? And he said, yes, if you're willing to work hard. I said, well, that's never been an issue for me. So I went out and found my own studio in Santa Fe. And I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, for a half a dozen years and pursued my art career there.
As an art collector and observer of many leading artists, who are some of your key inspirations and what drew you to them?
Well, I'd say any number of artists from the early 20th century, Henry Moore, Brancusi, an artist that I really am fond of, whose work I am fond of, who's well-known but not as well-known as those previous two names, is Archipenko. He was a Russian, and he moved to the United States, and he was quite renowned in the 1957 or so. Other artists, I could rattle off all kinds of names, you know, but the more contemporary sculptors also the Native American sculptors. I'm a big fan of Alan Hauser, who is a legend in Santa Fe. He was the first Native American artist, and he was a teacher at the Indian Arts Association and taught both gentlemen that helped me, Bill Prokopioff and Doug Hyde, were proteges of Alan Hauser. Hauser was the first one to get the Native American sculptors and visual artists to move away from typical Native art and move into a contemporary mode. And his mentors or his observations that resulted in his art or his sculpture were inspired by the very same people that have inspired me.
And how would you describe your now established creative process, techniques, and intuitive approach to your sculpture, perhaps giving our audience an example of how you approach your carving in stone and then perhaps some of your work in bronze?
I start generally with a drawing, a sketch. It could be a quick, what we refer to as a gesture study, say of a human form, which is a quick 2 to 5 minute, just trying to capture the energy in the human form. And it could be as simple as 3 lines. That's the simplest form. Others are more detailed development of the drawing. It depends on the material that I'm working in and the subject matter. In the case of the figure, I generally move from a drawing to making a maquette, a small clay model of that which I've drawn. That becomes a visual guide for carving the figure in stone. As for the animal work, that is usually comes as a result of the shape of the material. I work in marble, which I just described, and that's generally what I'll carve a human figure form from. As for an animal, I often carve that out of a piece of alabaster. Alabaster is a soft stone. It comes to you in boulder form, so it already has an envelope, so to speak, of a shape. And I learned again from the gentleman that I worked with or studied with that if you just look at that long enough, you're going to see an image within it and you can start to draw that out. Now, I will still probably make a sketch of that, may even make a model of that. But in the case of the boulder or the alabaster, it's more of a free-form form. It's my belief that people have never been up close to an animal. They've never really been up close to a bear or even, well, they've been up close to a fish or a horse. But the shape of the stone directs me in the design of the animal form. And that's kind of a fun thing to do. Whereas the figurative work is a little more serious. People have a pretty good understanding of what a human form looks like. They understand the proportion, a little more authentic in rendering the human form as to rendering an animal form.
Your works have very expressive, thoughtful titles, and how do you choose them? And can you describe a few of your pieces for us as you match them to their names?
Absolutely. I'll go back to the comment that I made earlier about figure versus animal. The animal forms, again, they're expressive and they bring a smile to the viewer. They're fun. So the names I've created are humorous, somewhat humorous names, like Asleep at the Wheel for a small bear, or Got It for a little larger bear. Bear Tango, two bears dancing, and they resemble two humans dancing. I don't know if bears ever dance, but that's what, when I created the piece, that's what came to my mind, so it was named Bear Tango. In the figurative pieces, they speak to the emotion that I'm trying to communicate through the form. So we have awakening, we have letting go, we have the way we are, my muse, and those are all speak to my emotional feelings that evolve at the time of the creation of the sculpture. You asked earlier about bronze casting. I do cast bronze, and I cast whole molds from not all, but selected stone carvings. So all of my work originates in one form of stone or another, and then I'll take the mold off of that stone piece, and from there go through the various steps required to render it in a bronze.
You've also been fortunate to be in the family of artists that Artwork International Incorporated represents. What has been your experience working with this organization?
They've been very helpful to me. The owner is a woman by the name of Samantha Ferguson. She's based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We've worked together almost from the beginning of my career. She does a number of wonderful things for me that include publicity, does all of the administrative work that I don't care to do, which is maintaining inventories, communication with galleries. She enters me in competitions, places me at museums. The list of things that she does is innumerable and very helpful. And it releases me to spend my time on what I want to spend my time with, which is being creative, not being a businessman anymore, not having to do with the routine of managing my art. Believe it or not, in the art business, administration, be it administration, marketing/sales, gallery communication, contact, which I do communicate with, but that takes an inordinate amount of time. And I'd rather spend my time in the studio creating than administering. So that's the service that Artworks provides, and it's been very helpful and been a successful partnership over the years.
Looking at time that you've been in the business of being an artist, you have a remarkably long list of works and accomplishments, solo and group shows. Your success in art has followed a similar pattern to your entrepreneurial success in business. So how do you see your strongest qualities have carried over from one world to the other?
Well, I think that it helped me enter the art world with a business background. I'm familiar with a number of artists who are extremely talented and create beautiful work, but they have no knowledge or desire to deal with the business side. As I just mentioned, I'd rather be creating. I think that's the nature of most artists. And when it comes to, you know, having to administer your business, most artists who have no prior business experience don't succeed because they're unable, because of knowledge or willingness, to apply themselves to that side of the business of art. It is a business. If you're going to be what's viewed as, if you're doing it just for your own satisfaction, that's one thing. If you're doing it for your own satisfaction and have the desire to sell the work that you create, you need to apply business principles to what you're doing. I think that because I had that background, I understood that, and that's been beneficial to me in succeeding as an artist.
And do you have any exhibitions or projects coming up that you're excited about and would like to share with our audience?
On the agenda right now, I have a major show in Santa Fe, New Mexico at the end of August, so I'm obviously preparing some new works for that show. And at the moment, I have some shows currently that are in my one in Loveland, Colorado right now. And I have one in Texas at the end of April, which will be a sculpture show in a community outside of Austin, Texas, called Round Rock, Texas. In fact, the featured artist there is the deceased artist, Alan Hauser. So my work will be on exhibit in conjunction with his and several other artists. So we have the April show in Texas, and we have the Santa Fe show in August. And currently there's a show of my work in Loveland, Colorado.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us tonight and sharing your insight and advice with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you continued success.
Well, thank you, Susan. It was a very pleasure talking to you.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Robert Landau, founder of Landau Fine Art in Montreal, a gallery highly renowned internationally for its masterworks and museum-quality exhibitions. Robert and his wife Alice have spent many years traveling extensively, collecting works by the great masters of the early to mid-20th century, such as Pablo Picasso, Henri Matisse, Henry Moore, and more, to offer their clients. Works in their collection have often been requested for loan by leading international museums for their exhibitions. Landau Fine Art has been the sole Canadian entry in the leading international art fairs, where their works are admired by thousands of visitors at each fair venue. Speaking with us from his home in Switzerland, Robert offers his insight on the art world from an art dealer's perspective. Hello, Robert, and welcome to Art World Innovators. Thank you so much for joining us today. Starting from the beginning, how did the Gallery of Landau Fine Art come into being?
came into being by accident more than by design in the middle 80s. At the time, I used to be involved in two other types of business. I had a private art collection, and art became very fashionable in the middle 80s with the Japanese, who were very actively buying the sort of things that we had been collecting. And they came and bought a number of artworks from us. And because of that, we decided to open a gallery and go into the art business.
And who were some of your mentors in the early days as you began your business?
Well, my mentors were quite varied, actually. One of my mentors was a man called Edward G. Robinson, who was one of the great art collectors of the world, actually, in the middle of the 20th century. He was an immigrant from Russia who arrived in New York with his family and knew nothing about really anything, didn't speak English, and went onto the stage in New York and then became famous for his role in gangster movies. And he had what we know in the art world as a pure eye. He used to go around the world whenever he had money in his pocket or when anybody would give him credit and buy great paintings. And he amassed a fantastic art collection, which in the middle 40s or the late 40s, he lost because he divorced his wife. And under California law, he had to divide his estate 50-50, and he didn't have the cash to buy her share. So he finished up selling his art to a man called Niarchos, who was a Greek ship owner, on the promise that Niarchos would sell him half back, but he never did. So he lost his collection, which, if it was valued today, would be worth many, many billions, billions with a B of dollars. And he formed a second art collection with his second wife, which was liquidated when he died in the early 70s. And I read his book, his autobiography, and learned about him. And he became a mentor for me because he looked at the paintings that he bought. He didn't buy for profit. He bought what he liked, and I was very fortunate to marry a young lady, we've been married now almost 50 years, who knew nothing about art whatsoever, had no college degree, no background in art history. But she had the same pure eye that Edward G. Robinson had, in that she is able to recognize great art. And with her help, we really, from the middle 80s, the gallery was actually formed in 1986, we grew in substance very, very quickly, not because we had a lot of money, but because we bought the right things. It's more important in art to buy the right painting rather than the best value painting. A lot of people don't understand how to look at art, but Alice does, and she has guided me from the early days when I used to be very macho and buy everything that I liked, when I was told by international art dealers to listen to my wife, and I did. I learned to listen. On the trade side of life, the most influential guide for me was a man called Ernst Beiler. He lived in Basel, Switzerland. He was a little bit like me in the way that he wasn't born into the art business. He used to be a book dealer and became, in one generation, the most important man in 20th century art. And today, the Beiler Foundation, which was built on Ernst Beiler's art collection, is the most well-attended museum in the whole of Switzerland. As a matter of fact, I was there the day before yesterday looking at the current exhibition. Ernst Beiler was very nice to me. He helped me. I lived in Montreal, and he helped me stage major art exhibitions for the benefit of Canadians, but it was really for the benefit of international collectors who came to Montreal not realizing what we had. And when they came and saw the quantity and the quality of art that we showed in Montreal in our little office on Sherbrooke Street, they said, we had no idea that Canada had this sort of art, and where else can we see more art like this? And, of course, there isn't anywhere else. I remember the director of the Montreal Museum was quoted once as saying he could only dream about owning the paintings that he saw at Lando Fine Art. So we grew quite quickly from the early 90s, when the market was in severe decline, when the Japanese were really going bankrupt all around us and selling off their paintings that they'd bought in the 80s for fortunes. And we survived those years really because of the quality of art that we owned. We never borrowed art to any major extent. There were some exceptions. Like I said, Ernst Beiler helped me with some exhibitions from time to time. So did Leslie Waddington. So did Louise Leiris Gallery in Paris. Some people trusted me and helped me climb up the ladder, as it were. And then we started doing international art fairs where we really blossomed, starting with Art Chicago in about 1990. Then moving on to Art Basel in the early 90s, and we've been showing at Art Basel and international art fairs really ever since that time, so probably now for about 25 years. Every time we go to an art fair in our small stand of about 1,500 to 2,000 square feet, or about 120 to 150 square meters, we welcome 100,000 people in about 5 or 6 days. It's an extraordinary amount of people who come in, more than most museums get in a year, but over time they have recognized that we build and present exceptional art collections like a small museum and an art fair. And during the time that we've shown at these art fairs, and they're not limited to Art Basel, I'm on the board of TAFAF Maastricht, which is, I think, the best art fair in the world. I'm also a director of the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. I was knighted by the French government and became a Chevalier des Arts et des Lettres, which I have been for some 15, 20 years now. But as we go around the world showing at these art fairs since the early 1990s, we have actually welcomed more than 10 million people to our shows. It's quite an extraordinary amount of people, but if you ever go to one of these fairs, like the next one we're going to is at Art Miami, the beginning of December, you will find out that there are more than 100,000 people that come to see us at every venue. So much so that when we showed in Paris last year at FIAC and we had President Macron's wife come into our stand, which was absolutely so full of people that you just couldn't move, she said she had never expected to see such beautiful paintings at FIAC. And she stayed with us in our stand for just about the whole of her visit. She was supposed to see 10 stands, but she finished up staying with us all the time. And we've had visits from Prince Charles's wife from England. We have visits from Queen Beatrix of Holland. We've had Givenchy sitting on one of our sculptures at 2 o'clock in the morning declaring it was the most beautiful piece of art he'd ever seen in his life, and so on. It's been like that. It's been a magical world for us where we've met hosts and hosts of really knowledgeable and very nice collectors, not all of them rich, some of them poor, but who appreciate what we do and what we show and the fact that they can get into close proximity with great art, mostly of the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century. We don't really get involved in too much contemporary art or living artists. We do on occasion, but I am very cynical of what is happening in the contemporary art world of today, whereby people are paying millions of dollars, sometimes tens of millions of dollars, for paintings where the paint is hardly even dry on the canvas. And they're buying art for investment, which is something that we do not get involved in. We do not sell investments. We sell art. We sell paintings that you can look at and see and like. And if you can afford them, you buy them. And most of the time, people buy from us because they value our expertise and the quality that we present. And that's been pretty much the story of Lando Fine Art over the last 30 years.
It's a fascinating story. Although you may not have many contemporary artists in your collection, your daughter is an accomplished contemporary painter and is fortunate to be able to exhibit through her family gallery. Can you tell us about her work?
Sarah, I think she was influenced more by the fact that I was in the fashion business when she was in her early years. I was in the fur trade. I ran the largest fur company in the world from 1960 to 1983. And she came into contact with fashion and with models, and I think her style of painting beautiful women has probably evolved from that experience. But she has got a wonderful talent, but she's not painting from hunger like Mr. Van Gogh and a few people like him. She she's not a prolific artist. And she has a queue of people waiting for her work. And the reason that she doesn't do exhibitions is because she doesn't have enough paintings to make an exhibition. The last time she did an exhibition was when she was invited to the MART, which is the largest and most important contemporary art museum in Italy. And she spent 2 years painting, I think it was about a dozen or 14 canvases for them. At the time when she did her show, they had two other exhibitions in the same museum, one of which came from the Phillips Collection in Washington, which is a renowned public institution and they have fantastic art. But Sarah actually outdrew the other two shows in the museum over that summer. So she does do something special, but she's not out there being promoted by the big contemporary galleries of the world simply because she doesn't paint enough. Having said that, we've been waiting patiently for two canvases from Sarah, which we will be showing at Art Miami in Florida the first week in September.
From some of the news articles and reports on the global art market, prices for works can be incredibly high, as you mentioned. What is your advice to young collectors about where and how to buy?
Well, my advice to young art collectors, or even old ones for that matter, is to open your eyes, to look, to go to as many exhibitions as you can, to visit as many museums as you can, and to find out what you like and what you think is good for you. It's a little bit like listening to music. You can't possibly know if you like Beethoven or if you like the Beatles unless you listen to them. And then your ear will tell you what you like. And if you then want to take advice from other people, then you should go to good professionals who can help you. But don't go to professionals who want to sell you futures or investments. You've got to realize that the art you take home is going to be the art you love and that you can live with. The reason you go to professionals is to find out if you're buying the best quality and if the art is in good condition and whether it fits well into the oeuvre of the artist, because I can promise you that Renoir, Picasso, Degas, Matisse never painted their best pictures on every day of the week. It doesn't work like that. So don't buy names. If you like an artist, search out the best of that artist and then buy it if you can afford it. I mean, the price is the last condition. Open your eyes, look, and see what you like, and then go to professionals that you can trust. From my experience coming out of the fur trade, where I dealt with auctions all my life, I would not recommend that you go to auctions for advice. Go to art dealers that you can trust, art dealers who've been in business for a while, so that in case anything goes wrong, you can go back and you can find them, and you will hopefully find one who's honest enough so that if you want to make a mistake or if you need help, they're always going to be there. Pick up the pieces if needed. That's my best advice to young or old collectors, any collectors for that matter. Be like Edward G. Robinson. Buy his book called All My Yesterdays, if you can, from a second-hand book dealer, and learn how he started. He started collecting cigar bands, you know, those little bands that go around cigars. Then he moved up to walking canes. And then he started buying paintings. And he used his experience and his personal eye and judgment to buy and assemble, like I said before, one of the great art collections of his generation. And he taught all the movie stars in California to buy art also. Many of those movie stars of his era followed his lead, and so did many of the directors and producers, and they built very important art collections in California. Much of those paintings are now residing in museums in that part of the world. So that's what you need to do. You need to open your eyes and look and walk. And he walked. He says in his book, he walked, and his wife and he walked around, and they wore out their shoes looking. You don't just go into the first art fair or gallery or auction house and buy a painting. That's not the way to do it. Get out and educate your eye. Try to learn what you can from people that you can trust.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for sharing your fascinating story with us and your excellent advice. Thank you.
Okay, and good luck.
That was Robert Landau, founder of Landau Fine Art in Montreal, speaking with us from Switzerland. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.